And the blameworthy one is the one that engages in vice, a gathering in which people are sitting there, when people are transgressing there, or some form of ma'siyat or sin is being committed there. These are all blameworthy types of gatherings. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the virtue of attending gatherings where Allah is remembered. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This one lay. Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the war in Ukraine, the U.S. President Joe Biden has ordered 3,000 reservists for European deployments, bringing the U.S. troop levels in that continent to over 100,000. And that's for the first time since the year 2005. This is while during the most recent NATO summit, divisions have surfaced between NATO members on issues like Ukraine's NATO membership. In this edition of the program, we will look at the Ukraine war's endless military support and military action, a process void of a diplomatic push to end the war, despite Ukraine's counteroffensive setbacks. First, let me introduce our guests. Desha Krishnaswamy is a journalist and podcaster joining us from St. Petersburg. Also joining us, Frank Emspach, radio producer and political commentator, who joins us from Madison. Great. Welcome to you both. Frank Emspach, I'm going to start with you, and I'm double-checking the figure for these troops. It stands at 3,000, the number that the U.S. president has ordered to be activated in Europe, and that puts the troop levels to over 100,000 for the first time since the year 2005. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, the last time we heard the figure 100,000 was during the war in Afghanistan. Why would there be such a massive troop buildup in European countries?
Well, I think that President Biden is trying to make a statement vis-a-vis Ukraine without sending any American troops to Ukraine. This increasingly looks like the same kind of rhetoric and political positioning that took place during the Cold War, when the Democratic presidents of the United States generally ran their elections on a combination of some investment domestically and mobilization against at that time, the Soviet Union internationally. And I think we're seeing the same type of model being applied here. Also, it's a way to try to deflect a political opposition that's growing amongst the right wing and the Republican Party to the war in Ukraine. And I suspect also growing in places in Europe as it becomes clear that the United States is not really interested in a settlement there. And that is getting some people uncomfortable, not that many at this point.
All right, well, talk about differences here. Esha, let me point out, I'm sure you're well aware of this, how Zelensky lost his temper. It was an unprecedented somewhat of an incident where, when it comes to what has happened, it was about the wording, I guess, in the NATO summit, most recent NATO summit that happened. where you have basically him reacting in a way where he said that there shouldn't be any conditions that should be attached to the way that Ukraine should join NATO. What do you make, first of all, of Zelensky's anger when it came to that towards NATO as a whole?
Well, I mean, it is somewhat justified if you look at it from Zelensky's point of view, because since 1994, the U.S. NATO countries have been kind of dragging this reward, like bait along for Ukraine in order to, mainly a lot of these conditions are having to do with the kind of weapons, and they call it getting the military ready. And it's just, for the most blunt way to put it, is to get Ukraine to buy weapons from these weapons manufacturers. So from his point of view, he's completely justified. But of course, we all know, because of Article 5, if one is in the war, all of them have to join the war. And since that would involve multiple nuclear powers, it's not going to happen. And so it is the that is the basic conundrum, is that NATO cannot actually have Ukraine join because it is going to mean a big World War III.
I mean, not to make it a big deal, Frank M. Spack, but is it a big deal? I mean, let's take a look at, for example, who's against this. And at the forefront, it seems like it's the U.S. and Germany, who obviously are insisting on dialing back this NATO membership, invitation, if you want to use another word, be my guest. They both have told the Ukraine that you can't join because you can't have a country at war join NATO. The Ukraine minister actually said that Ukraine should show a lot of gratitude for weapons, where it was interesting when the Ukrainian foreign minister said, "I'm not Amazon." So what do you think about this, what appears to be cracks between Zelensky?
I think we make up rules as we go along, you know, that are useful. It's pretty clear that the United States is a nuclear power, that if we say Ukraine's in NATO and Article 5, which requires all countries to defend somebody who's attacked, you're at war with Russia. And then Biden has said that. He says, I don't want to do that, which is a good thing, right? The other nuclear powers don't count, France, England, and we never took them seriously and don't now. So as far as he's concerned, it's in the interest of the United States, and I think of humanity, not to have a nuclear war with Russia. That's a good thing. On the other hand, the United States and a number of the other countries are not willing to recognize something which is obviously historically accurate, namely that Crimea has been part of what is Russia now since about the 17th century, and that entire part of eastern Ukraine is really Russian-speaking. And so if the position of our country is that Crimea goes back to Ukraine and everybody has to go back to square one, it's not going to work. And so to the extent that they're trying to draw this line of support to Ukraine but not have a nuclear war, okay, we understand that. But that's what it is. And I think that's pretty clear. NATO is expanding elsewhere. I mean, who ever heard of the North Atlantic being someplace in the Japan Sea, that which is where they were meeting about a month ago, if I recall. So you have still the development of an organization outside the United Nations, controlled by the United States, which isn't just Europe or in parts of the Middle East with Turkey, but looking at Australia, Japan, Singapore, South Korea. I mean, what are we talking about here? That is really what's going on as we move forward.
Okay, another instance of cracks within the alliance has come over something that maybe was not evident at first for it to show that, and that is the, election of a new NATO chief, which seems like they are very, insistent on keeping Jens Stoltenberg. What has happened there, Esha? Why is it that they don't want to put somebody else, even though there's been talk about it? And one of the interesting points about this is a number of NATO allies wanted a former head of state or government in charge. France insisted on someone from an EU country. The UK is not part of the EU anymore, but it didn't get the US backing. So there seems to be obviously divisions there. What do you make of it?
Well, the main vision. The main interest with Stoltenberg is that he is a hawk that it has promised unwavering support for Ukraine at any cost. And so they know that with him in charge, the NATO policy, whatever it is, it cannot be steered. But we also know that there are cracks within NATO. For example, the Turkey-Sweden issue. And of course, France is having some domestic issues as well as Germany. And so it's not a united front. And so France, I think, wants to step back again with this war because it's domestically too painful for them and too much shock. So I think that is the thing we're seeing. But what this ultimately shows is that NATO is 100%, like the people in charge are the U.S. because it doesn't really matter what these other countries think. It's usually the U.S. policy that gets pushed forward.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, let's move on to another topic, which is of great concern, and I think it will continue to be as such, Frank Emspach, and that is the whole issue of weapons and the quantities available. Now, an interesting statement came out from the UK Defense Secretary when it came to Zelensky's anger outburst, if you want to call it that, where he said in a message to Zelensky, "You're persuading countries to give up their stock of weapons and ammunition." When he says that, what do you make of it? I mean, are they running that low, which would in turn make them vulnerable as a country in terms of their ammunition? Is that a correct assessment of it?
I have no idea. It's hard for me to believe that the United States is running out of ammunition, and therefore they can't give more to the Ukrainians, and we can't ramp up production here to meet the needs of the army and the Ukrainians, so therefore we have to give them cluster bombs. I mean, that's the line here. So it's hard for me to believe that, but it's possible. It's possible that because of the nature of the way the Ukrainians are fighting the war. So we have given weapons to lots of people. With these particular shells, howitzer shells, are not cheap or easy to make sometimes. So it's possible that we're running out of ammunition, and therefore it's a problem. The defense industry, of course, has their own interests here to squeeze as much profit out of this as possible. So it's hard to know what the actual level and whether it's really true. I just can't believe that we're not going to be able to defend Guam if we give more officers to the Ukraine. I think a more fundamental issue is, are we prepared to give them long-range strategic missions, missiles and whatnot, that are going to allow the Ukrainians to launch an offensive war against Russia? And that is the point that there's debate about, whether it's the F-16 fighter planes or whether it's certain types of missiles or other things. And I think there is going to be the where the rubber meets the road in terms of divisions within NATO, where the Europeans, who are going to bear the brunt of this, are saying, let's not do that. And here in the United States, there is pressure to increase the type and the scope of weapons we're giving the Ukraine. And that has happened pretty much since the beginning of this war.
All right. I'm going to get back to you on that point. But I'd like to ask you on another point that Frank Emspach talked about there, Isha, and that is F-16 jets, where Russia has said that is going to be seen as a, quote, nuclear threat. And the reason they have given is its capacity to carry atomic weapons. Valid concern, do you think?
Absolutely. It definitely is capable of launching atomic missiles very close in, or in fact, inside of Russia. So, yes, they can consider it a nuclear threat if Ukraine has a nuclear weapon head or a missile. But what is more dangerous is that it will allow for the war to come into Russian territory. For now, most, if you ignore the few incursions in Belgorod, it has been mostly contained inside of the Donbas region. So if there are F-16 jets, Russia would be legitimate to think that it is going to be more of like an offensive war that will hit Russian territory. So they will want to respond more aggressively, and that may include like hitting weapons caches or hangars in Poland, Germany, Czech Republic, wherever else the U.S. has decided to have their weapons cache. So it'll only escalate the war, in my opinion.
All right, Frank Emspeck, you talked about the F-16, and you talked about long-range, I guess, missiles in particular. That is something that is being debated, maybe thought of, but not provided yet to Ukraine. I'm wondering what the thinking is when it comes to the way, of, which have now been over 500 days, of how the U.S. has dispersed, along with its NATO partners, the military equipment to Ukraine. Because it seems like every so often they're releasing a new type of equipment. I mean, when the slow progress, first of all, now they've committed to $1.3 billion. The counteroffensive not going well, cluster munitions, slow progress before Abrams tanks. And you can see where I'm going with this. My question is, what is the thinking here when they're doing this? Because it's not that they're getting the desired results, so they're upping the, I guess, strength of the military equipment that they're releasing to Ukraine. Is that what the thinking is?
Well, it's an approach to war that's different. That you can win a war with increasingly sophisticated and targeted technology if you don't have the support on the ground. One of the reasons you fire hundreds of thousands of shells at somebody is because you don't have troops who are willing to occupy the territory without that kind of stuff. And it has also not proved effective in Vietnam, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, Iran. So, it's a pretty fundamental issue. One of the interesting things about the tanks that we provided, there was a great video clip the other day that was distributed worldwide. Everybody saw it on CNN, Al Jazeera, and everything else, where these very, very expensive Abrams tanks going forward, and one of them got hit with something and stopped, and then the others went back because people weren't willing to risk $63 million or whatever each one costs. So there's limits to this. There's limits to, apparently limits to, the real efficacy of some of these weapons, because ultimately, if you're going to win a war, you have to win it on the ground, and you have to have motivated, trained troops to do that. And I think that's fundamentally the problem here for the Ukrainians, and I think for us. We've always, in the last 30 or 40 years, tried to, since including in Vietnam, try to win these wars with an overwhelming firepower based on whatever the most modern technology was at the time, combined with real weapons that are most people now have decided are war crimes, like cluster bombs, and aimed at civilians, incidentally. So that strategy doesn't seem to have changed here, but it also hasn't worked.
Well, you talk about cluster munitions. I'm just wondering, Esha, what it is when it comes to the definition of a war being won. I mean, when you take a look at the strategy here, what it looks like from the outside is that Ukraine is just trying to stop Russia from advancing. That's what it seems like they're doing. They're not on Russian soil.
It may be, but what they've said, that their objectives, Zelensky has been very clear, and nobody has contradicted it. He said his objectives are to free Ukrainian territory, as he put it,
okay,
from Russians, as well as getting back Crimea.
Well,
and I just, that's what he says winning is.
Well, Esha, I'd like to get your idea on this, because there's a big difference by defeating Russia or stopping Russia. I think what they're doing is they're preventing Russia or stopping Russia from advancing, because that seems like the best they can do. And if you take a look at the Ukrainian territory, as a result, it's being decimated and destroyed.
Well, what we have to remember is that east of the Don River, there is no popular support. In fact, the chief of police in December said that the biggest problem for Kiev is the people of Donbas, and we know this because since like 2014, a lot of these oblasts declared independence, like not just Lugansk and Donetsk, but Kharkiv and even Odessa and Crimea. And with Crimea, they've always considered themselves to be Russian territory, and because of the events of Maidan, it motivated them to secede. So that is not a realistic objective, but stopping Russia is also hard. So in order to actually retake back the territories of Lugansk and Donetsk, they need to engage in full counterinsurgency, which is a war against the civilian population. And of course, that is the only option. Like, they have to do that because they do not have popular support there. So, but of course, the more realistic option, given the training, the military, and the state of the Russia military, is trying, not even stopping, but slowing down Russia's objectives, because Russia is actually going at a very deliberate, slow pace, because it's a war of attrition and not a war of conquest. And so, and of course, the U.S. only is used to fighting people or non-equal powers. So bigger and bigger firepower is not going to help in this war. And that's the only thing Ukraine is left with, unfortunately.
Taking a look at some of the consequences of this war that have been persisting for quite some time, may appear like Frank Imsmack, maybe it's not impacting the issues that I'm going to ask you about, such as energy, such as the grain supply deal with Russia, such as the way that budgets are getting drained, where you have these protests happening overall in Europe. I mean, those things are still matters of concern. I mean, right now we're in the middle of summer, pretty much in a heat wave, but winter is going to be coming around, and there are a lot of question marks as to the amount of storage capacity European countries have when it comes to their energy reserves, which is very doubtful that they can actually meet that. Are they not a bit at all concerned about what's going to happen then?
Are you asking me? I'll tell you, from the American point of view, okay, you've had a situation where a gas market, which had been previously closed to Texas and Louisiana and whatnot, is now 100% theirs. Gas exports are through the roof. So those guys are thrilled, okay? The second thing is conventional weapons. You know, they couldn't be running more hours per day. So those guys, Lockheed and the rest of them, are thrilled. So from that point of view, people are not, you know, those parts of the ruling class here are thrilled. Now let's talk about the grain people. What do they make their money on? They make their money in arbitrage, raising grain prices. Archer Daniel Midland and the rest of them. So they're not exactly running to the administration and crying here. So from certain ways, America, the American military industrial complex, and the energy complex is doing quite well with the war, just as it is. What the effect is on the Europeans and their standard of living, that's another question, okay, which is one reason there may have...
Which I'll leave. I'm sorry to jump in. I'll give that question to Esha. So, yeah. U.S. military complex at the expense of Europeans, what do you think? 30 seconds.
Oh, okay. Well, of course it is at the expense of Europeans, because they are really hurting from the lack of cheap gas. And in fact, sometimes they have to launder Russian gas through India by paying a premium. And of course, it also has German industries, because we've seen many factories shut down. So of course they're hurting. And this again shows you how non-sovereign a lot of these NATO countries are.
Pleasure. Thank you. Esha Krishnadwamy, journalist and podcaster from St. Petersburg. Frank Imsmack, thank you so much. Radio producer and political commentator from Madison. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vatav and the team, it's goodbye.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the verses of chapter Nur, the 24th chapter of the Holy Quran, and different commentary points of these verses. Brothers and sisters, let's listen to the 19th and 20th verses of this chapter.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. إن الذين يحبون أن تشيع الفاحشة في الذين آمنوا لهم عذاب أليم في الدنيا والآخرة والله يعلم وأنتم لا تعلمون.
Indeed, those who like that immorality should be spread among those who have believed will have a painful punishment in this world and the hereafter. And Allah knows, and you do not know.
ولولا فضل الله عليكم ورحمته وأن الله رؤوف رحيم.
And if it had not been for the favor of Allah upon you and His mercy, and because Allah is kind and merciful.
Dear listeners, the point that we can say is that in this verse, for leaving no doubt, the words are changed from expressing a private phenomenon into statement of a general and comprehensive rule. I mean, it should be known that interest in spreading indecency is sometimes materialized by tongue and pen, and sometimes by setting up some centers of abomination and wickedness, encouraging others to commit sin, providing others with facilities for doing wrong actions and committing sin. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, "One who hears or sees something about a believer and retells it for others is among the examples of this verse." إِنَّ الَّذِينَ يُحِبُّونَ أَن تَشِيعَ الْفَاحِشَةُ فِي الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا. He is from among those who love that indecency is spread concerning those who believe. So this verse, as a general and comprehensive rule, states, إِنَّ الَّذِينَ يُحِبُّونَ أَن تَشِيعَ الْفَاحِشَةُ فِي الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا. Verily, those who love that indecency is spread concerning the life of those who believe. لَهُمْ عَذَابٌ أَلِيمٌ فِي الدُّنْيَا وَالْآخِرَةِ. For those will be a painful punishment in the world and hereafter. It is worth studying, worth noting, that the verse does not say those who spread indecency, but it says الَّذِينَ يُحِبُّونَ أَن تَشِيعَ الْفَاحِشَةِ. Those who love that indecency should be spread. And this is the ultimate emphasis on this field. In other words, it says it must not be thought that such insistence and emphasis is just for the sake that the wife of the Prophet ﷺ or someone as important as her is accused. But if such a thing happens to anyone and to every faithful person, this emphasis, this insistence will be applied to that person because other aspects will be added to it. And we must pay careful attention to the fact that spreading indecency is not allocated to only spreading false, baseless accusations of a faithful man and woman and to accuse them of an unchaste action. This is only one example. And this verse, of course it is general, is not limited to it. This phrase has got a very wide concept. This verse involves every kind of corruption, every kind of spreading indecency and giving help to its development. Of course, in the Holy Quran, the Arabic word fahisha or fahsha is mostly applied to sexual deviations, but philologically speaking, as Raghib says in the Book of Mufradat, fuhsh and fahsha refer to any kind of behavior and speech that the obscenity of it is very bad and great.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Dear listeners, as it is said in the Holy Quran, it is sometimes used in the vast meaning. I mean, the word fahisha and fahsha is used as a general term, although it is mostly used and applied to sexual deviations and obscenity in honor, but it has a general meaning. And those who shun the great sins and indecencies, this is what the Holy Quran says. So the extent of the concept of a verse gets completely clear. It is so general. But the sentence, "theirs will be a painful punishment in the world and hereafter," may refer to religiously prescribed punishments, those social reactions and individual gloomy consequences that in this very world will catch those who commit these actions. Moreover, their deprivation from the right of testimony and their condemnation to disgrace and iniquity are also its other worldly signs. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode as well. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us.
If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
When faith begins.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
On Thursday, tens of thousands of rail workers in Italy staged a day-long walkout over pay and safety at work, hampering public transportation services and tourists' access to their destinations. The strike action, called by the three largest trade unions, CGL, CISL and WIL, caused cancellations and delays to national and regional trains at the peak of the country's booming high tourist season. Italy, like much of Europe, is suffering from high inflation and stagnant economic growth, and unions are protesting against low wages, especially in relation to the ongoing increase in the cost of living.
Today's action revolves around two issues. We demand an adjustment of the collective pay agreements for our sector and more hiring to ease pressure on employees and their unsustainable workloads. Furthermore, more investments on railway maintenance are needed. Last-minute negotiations with the Transport Ministry failed on Tuesday. The government showed up too late.
Also, air transport workers are set to down tools on Saturday despite Transport Minister Matteo Salvini's attempts to persuade unions to call off the strikes. This new industrial action, the latest in a long line of transport strikes, is widely expected to be more disruptive than most, which are generally only backed by one or two major unions. Commuters are once again facing delays and cancellations. They are saying they are at the end of their rope.
Disruptions keep affecting us. It's not just about tourists. Commuters are those who are bearing the brunt for the mismanagement of our public transport system. This way, they force people to resort to their cars.
Workers' wages in Italy are excessively low. I understand those who are staging the strike. As a result, commuters are left to face the music.
About 90% of rail transport sector workers joined the strike called by CGL, CISL and WIL unions. Even high-speed lines that are usually guaranteed during Italy's frequent work stoppages were affected. Max Civili, Rome.
A familiar sight as the summer of strikes and disruptions in England rolls on. While some health workers have settled, junior doctors, who form 40% of the workforce in the National Health Service here, are still locked in a bitter war of words with the government. They say the request of a 35% pay rise is an opening offer and accuse the government of negotiating in bad faith. And while the deadlock continues, it's the patients who are paying the price, as hundreds of thousands of appointments and operations are postponed, despite Prime Minister Rishi Sunak setting cutting the NHS waiting list now at more than 7 million as a top priority.
The government argues that any pay rises funded through borrowing for these junior doctors or others in the public sector risk fueling the inflation that's highest among the G7 advanced economies. But not everyone agrees with that.
The cause of inflation is not the workers asking for wage rises. It's the printing of money. You see, central banks want to blame everybody but themselves. They printed the money. The US did it, the UK did it, the Europeans did it.
As the strike got underway, an announcement by the Prime Minister saying his government's offer for pay rises was the last such offer and that there would be no more negotiations with the unions. But with the tens of thousands of nurses and doctors having quit last year, the strikers say the pay rises are needed to keep them in the profession.
People are leaving the profession and we're losing staff. They're going across to Australia, New Zealand, America to get paid more money. But also within the UK, they're taking on more private work, equivalent private work.
This month, we'll also see disruption under railways as an overtime ban for train drivers comes into force and as staff walk off altogether yet again. For the time being, disputes dragging on, plenty of problems for the government, few simple solutions. Saeed Purza, London.
Common wound among the Iranian and Japanese nation. Following the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Sardash became the third city to endure an attack by a weapon of mass destruction. Sardash, the first city to suffer a chemical attack, hosted a Japanese diplomatic delegation to commemorate the victims of this assault. According to Shiva, the wife of one of the victims of Sardash, her husband is still suffering from the consequences of the attack that occurred 36 years ago.
Because of the sanctions, I can't get the appropriate medicine for my husband. He has been suffering from chemo for a long time.
36 years ago, Western countries including the United States, England and Germany provided Iraqi dictator Saddam with chemical weapons which he used on Iranian people. This action has not been condemned by any human rights body in the world. Mr. Murakami from the Japanese delegation emphasized the importance of telling the world about the crimes that took place in Sardash, saying this was the reason for their visit to the town.
I think it is important for the world to get to know about what happened in Sardash some 30, 40 years ago. So I think it's very important for me to really come visit this place.
The international community has turned a blind eye on this brutal chemical attack in the last 36 years. We can hope such meetings and gatherings can pave the way to raise the voice of the victims of this brutal attack. Farzana Shirin, Sardash.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol traveled to Vilnius, Lithuania to participate in his second NATO summit as he seeks the bloc's support in deterring North Korea.
As Secretary General Stoltenberg has mentioned, we are in the situation where the security in the Atlantic cannot be separated from the security in the Indo-Pacific region.
NATO has requested South Korea send military aid to Ukraine. And while Seoul has restricted its assistance to non-lethal aid, NATO maintains interest in South Korea taking a greater role in the pact.
Nuclear and missile programs of North Korea. This affects all NATO allies and underlines the importance of all those who believe in the rules-based order to stand together.
South Korea signed an 11-point cooperation agreement with NATO on the first day of the Vilnius summit. South Korea's President Yoon has sought to strengthen the country's alliance with the United States since coming to office in May of 2022. But now his efforts to boost defense ties and up the pressure on North Korea take on new dimensions with South Korea's cooperation agreement with NATO. However, in South Korea, the Yoon government's moves to court NATO membership draw concern.
As NATO's expansion and military progress are strengthened, and the U.S. intention to build a global alliance is strengthened, the confrontation structure of the new Cold War, where confrontations and crises take place on a daily basis, will be strengthened. Also, peace in Asia, the Pacific region, and the Korean Peninsula in Northeast Asia will be destroyed.
North Korea, meanwhile, launched a ballistic missile on the second day of the NATO summit. Tensions have been high, with the U.S. and South Korea holding large-scale military drills and planning to again soon deploy a U.S. nuclear submarine to South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Seventeen years have passed since Israel launched its biggest full-scale war against Lebanon, apart from the 1982 invasion. The Israeli Air Force bombarded the infrastructure of Lebanon, threw cluster munitions in most of southern Lebanon, and killed over 1,200 people. The town of Bint Jbeil witnessed some of the most fierce fighting during the 2006 war. This market was turned to rubble, yet that was a cost the people of Lebanon were ready to pay if it meant that Israel would be deterred from launching another act of aggression. The fighting here turned to hand-to-hand combat at times, and the Israelis were still incapable of dislodging Hezbollah while resistance rockets increased. Strategy experts believe that before 2006, Hezbollah's main goal was a strategy of defense. Yet the fighting capabilities of the resistance has reached an extent where launching a preemptive war against the Israelis is plausible. Israel's internal investigations into the July war proved that it was a failed mission for the regime. Yet Hezbollah's military presence remains intact and its popular support stronger than ever before. The 2006 July war gave birth to a new equilibrium in the conflict between Lebanon and Israel, and it proved that Hezbollah was not to be taken lightly. Israel's worst fear now is that any wrong move could fight Hezbollah in the Galilee region. Maryam Saleh, Marun Ras, South Lebanon.
The wheels of the British economy are turning, but not fast enough, and the state of the job market is one indicator. The UK's Office for National Statistics says the unemployment rate jumped to 4% into 3 months to May this year, up from 3.8% previously, driven by wage rises and by people out of work for up to 12 months.
Well, employment levels are high, but the trouble with Britain is we got less people working than pre-COVID. So we got record levels in employment. We're not far off the record levels. But the number of people in jobs has gone down because we've got this sort of 600,000 to 900,000 people seem to have disappeared from the workforce.
Finance Minister Jeremy Hunt has put getting Britons back into work at the heart of his plan for economic growth. Yet more than 1 million people are still unemployed. Let's see how the UK economy compares with other advanced economies. The Paris-based Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, says year-on-year inflation in the group of seven wealthy nations fell to 4.6% in May this year, down from 5.4% in April, reaching its lowest level since September 2021, making the UK the only country in the G7 where inflation is at 8.7%.
Well, the cause of inflation is not the workers asking for wage rises. It's the printing of money. You see, central banks want to blame everybody but themselves. They printed the money. The US did it, the UK did it, the Europeans did it. But, of course, Britain has the additional problem of Brexit, and that has pushed up inflation costs across the economy. It's the only explanation for the big differential.
The Bank of England, whose job it is to control inflation, has responded with increasing the interest rate 13 times so far, with more interest rate rises on the horizon. That has seen mortgage rates soar, making repayments more difficult for homeowners, many of whom have seen their salaries squeezed by inflation, setting off a tidal wave of public sector strikes over the past year.
The government here has promised labor market reforms, including expanding free childcare next year, hoping to encourage more and more people to go back to work and fill in those hundreds of thousands of vacancies that it says are fueling inflation. But the fact remains that the rate of economic growth and inflation in the UK remain particularly bad compared to similar economies. Saeed Bourizat, London.
to protest last week's burning of the Holy Quran in Stockholm. The Ansarullah-backed Yemeni government has officially banned all Swedish imports into Yemen. This means the Yemeni market will no longer carry almost 500 Swedish brands. The desecration of the Quran has sparked Muslim outrage and condemnation against the Swedish government, who continue to insist the Sacrilegious Act is a part of freedom of speech.
It is a revolutionary Yemeni people who decided that Swedish products should be banned from Yemen. We also call on all neighboring countries and the Islamic world to take a decisive stand against this act of aggression against Islam. At the very least, Muslim nations should ban all Swedish products.
According to the Minister of Trade, the Sana'a government has put together an economic plan to boost the battered Yemeni economy and compensate for the products which have been banned. They believe this will help Yemen move towards self-sufficiency.
The ban on Swedish products only took place after much research and study on pragmatic solutions needed to replace the banned products. There are going to be many positive steps and decisions the government will take in order to increase and promote local production to stimulate the economy.
That has been involved in what they described as a war on Islam.
The banning of products from Sweden, Israel, the United States and the UK is an obligation on all Muslims worldwide. This is because of the hate and aggression these nations have toward Muslims and Islam. These are people who do not respect the religion of Allah. The banning of products from these nations is a positive step forward to teach them a lesson so that we can depend on ourselves and increase local production and industry.
The Ansarullah-backed Yemeni government said it is funding plans and initiatives to revive Yemeni production. This is necessary in order to provide food security for millions of Yemenis who have suffered tremendously from food shortages caused by the 8 year of Saudi-imposed blockade on Yemen.
The fact is, although boycotting goods from nations that support insulting Islam has some impact, it is simply not enough. This is why the Sana'a government is calling for a united Islamic front to cut off all ties with Sweden and any nation involved in sacrilegious acts against Islam. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
In an unexpected move, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said European countries need to pave the way for Ankara's bid to join the EU in return for the Turkish parliament approving Sweden's accession to NATO. Erdogan made the comments at the airport before heading towards Lithuania to attend the bloc summit. Ankara has been holding off its approval for Sweden's NATO membership along with Hungary, while all other members have already approved its accession. Hungary has signaled that it will follow Erdogan's lead should he give the green light for Sweden to join the military alliance.
I'm calling here for these countries that are making Turkey wait for the door of European Union for more than 50 years. First, come and open the way for Turkey at the European Union, and then we will open the way for Sweden, just as we did for Finland.
Turkey signed a customs union agreement with the European Union in 1995 and was officially recognized as a candidate on December 1999. However, its membership bid was stalled due to what the EU said were Ankara's democratic backsliding and its dispute with the bloc member Cyprus.
I think Turkey's accession to EU is unlikely to happen now, for the EU's mentality is the same. They need to change the way they see Turkey. EU will not accept a country with Islamic background to become an acting member in the bloc. The EU still sees Turkey as it was before, not as it has become now, a key player in all regional issues.
US President Joe Biden is set to meet with his Turkish counterpart on the sidelines of the summit. Sources close to the White House say Biden is to persuade Erdogan by approving an F-16 deal between Washington and Ankara, should the latter give the green light to Sweden's membership. The coming 2 days will witness intense negotiations between Turkey and NATO member states, with many wondering if it would end with Turkey's accession to the EU. Probably not, but Ankara will definitely harvest gains. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
J
Just after the Friday prayers at the National Mosque in Abuja, the demonstrators raised placards condemning the desecration of the Quran in Sweden. The protesters later marched on the streets, raising the Quran in solidarity with Muslims around the world. They later stopped for a rally and called on all Muslims and people with moral sense to condemn the deliberate act. The demonstrators have condemned in strong terms the sacrilege under the guise of freedom of expression. They said it is unacceptable to insult Muslims by desecration of the Holy Quran.
We are condemning this atrocity because this is trampling upon our right as Muslims. Attacking or burning the Holy Quran is as burning all the Muslims or even humanity in general, because you must respect what people respect. So we are condemning what happened in Sweden. By so doing, we are protesting so that such a thing should not happen elsewhere again.
The most significant part of the rally was the burning of the Swedish flag in condemnation of the provocative act. The demonstrators accused the Swedish government, the Europeans, and the United States of complicity in the plot to insult and provoke Muslims around the world.
You don't fight ideology with a barbaric act. The affair is the growth of Islam. If you look at the global trend, recent survey shows that the most popular name in the world is Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. I look at the trend of Islam and Muslims in Europe. Definitely they are worried, and they have a reason to be worried. But it is the era of Islam.
Sweden has an infamous history of Islamophobic acts, and over the years, Muslims have been the target of violence simply because of their religion there. Benjamin Abdullahi, Abuja.
In the limelight.
Majority of adults in the United States say U.S. laws and policies do a poor job of representing what most Americans want on issues ranging from the economy to government spending to gun policy, immigration, and abortion. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Associated Press news agency has covered the story and tells us more. According to a new opinion poll, only about 1 in 10 American adults give high ratings to the way democracy is working in the United States or how well it represents the interests of most Americans. Majority of adults in the U.S. say laws and policies do a poor job of representing what most Americans want on issues ranging from the economy to government spending to gun policy, immigration, and abortion. The new opinion poll from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research shows that 53% of the American public says Congress is doing a bad job of upholding democratic values, compared with just 16% who say it's doing a good job. The findings illustrate widespread political alienation as a polarized country limps out of the pandemic and into a recovery haunted by inflation and fears of recession. In interviews, respondents worried less about the machinery of democracy, voting laws and the tabulation of ballots, and more about the output. Overall, about half the country, or 49%, say democracy is not working well in the United States, compared with 10% who say that it's working very or extremely well, and 40%